station. I thought arrangements were made. I waited three fucking hours instead. Seems like I
good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonance.com on the other wireless. Today is Friday the 13th of April. And in spite of this doom-laden portent, I feel very lucky to have with me today sound artist John Wynn and artist curator Richard Ducker. John Wynn's CV is an ever-expanding phenomenon which is becoming too cumbersome and time-consuming to read out. But a brief précis might include award-winning work for museums, galleries, public spaces and radio. Long-term projects include working with speakers of endangered languages in Africa and Canada and with heart and lung patients in the UK. For 3 years, John hosted Upcountry on Resonance, where he invited Tammy Wynette to have tea with Pierre Henry in a thunderstorm. That quote by Ed Baxter. More recently, John's installation for 300 speakers, Loud, Not Human, Player Piano and Vacuum Cleaner, was developed at Beaconsfield Gallery and then became the first piece of sound art to be purchased and exhibited by the Saatchi Gallery. Richard Ducker has been a practicing artist since completion of his MA at Goldsmiths College, London. He is a curator and co-founder with Sonia Park of Fieldgate Gallery, a non-commercial, not-for-profit gallery which does not represent any of the artists who have participated in shows, which at the last count available to me numbered 271 artists. The gallery was never a hire space. The reason for both artists being here together today is the exhibition at Angus Hughes Gallery on Lower Clapton Road, East London, which presents an exhibition by John Wynne called Installation No. 2 for High and Low Frequencies, curated by Richard Ducker for Fieldgate Gallery. Just as I was writing this introduction, I received an email from John telling me that Richard couldn't make it due to a sore throat, so the portents were right. Sorry to hear that, Richard. Get well soon. And as I speak, John Wynne has started to look slightly off colour, and actually I'm feeling a bit queasy myself. Thanks for coming in, John. Are you superstitious?
Am I coming through? I can't hear myself.
Yes, you're coming through.
All right. Yep. did you call my work tedious and cumbersome?
I'd have to go back a bit. Tedious? No, I think it was the.
It's just my CV that's getting tedious and cumbersome.
It was an ever expanding. Your CV is an ever expanding. I see you're fishing for me to repeat the introduction. John Wynne's CV is an ever-expanding phenomenon, which is becoming too cumbersome and time-consuming to read out,
I guess I made up the tedious bit.
You must have imagined it. It was your own your own
so
thought.
So am I superstitious? Yes and no.
Okay. This probably sounds like me. We'll leave it at that. Perhaps we should... we could... describe the installation, perhaps, at the Angus Hughes Gallery, which kicked off when?
It opened last Thursday.
Right.
And the gallery, I'll dig the address out later, it's in Dalston. The gallery's open Friday.
It's sort of Lower
Friday
Clapton Road,
Sunday.
Isn't it? I have to say,
yeah,
it's quite... how long has this gallery been there?
It's been there for quite some time.
Has it?
Angus Hughes, yeah.
Right.
Richard has curated a few shows there under the Fieldgate banner, but other people have curated shows there as well.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. So it's, as the title said, I'm calling it Installation No. 2 for High and Low Frequencies. Installation No. 1 was at Rochelle School back in September. And I wanted to develop the ideas a bit further and make a new site-specific piece for this gallery.
Right. So what are the essential differences between the Rochelle one and this one?
The site is very different, so that inevitably kind of makes the work different because it's very much site-specific. In both cases, I sat in the space for, in the Angus Hughes case, for 2 weeks making the work, partly because I'm using two huge subwoofers on loan to me from Function One.
Yeah.
Thank you, Function One.
That's Function spelt with a K, isn't it?
As in
funk.
Yeah.
So we got... with good reason. I mean, they're pretty impressive.
Well, they're normally
kit,
used for clubs big concert situations and things.
But, yeah. And it should be, these are massive white sort of speakers, one at each end of the gallery.
That's correct, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And that much is in common with the Rochelle School. I had one of these subwoofers at each end of the space. Using the reason I use two is that I'm playing two very low frequency tones slightly different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And when you play low frequencies, any frequencies that are slightly apart from each other, one slightly higher than the other, you get a phenomenon called beating.
Okay.
If you look at the waveforms, it's clear that when the waveforms are coinciding on their peaks, the sound gets louder, and when they're canceling each other out, you get a quiet bit. So you get this kind of pumping sound, which you can... That sets up a rhythm, and you can...
So is this created sort of between the speakers then? This is where the sounds from each speaker hit each other or encounter each other within the space.
Exactly. Those beat frequencies, those beat rhythms are only happening in the space between the speakers. So if you were to take one of the speakers out while it's playing, those beat... tones would frequencies would disappear.
And what, when you say beat tones, how does that sort of manifest itself? Is it like a throb or a you're hearing?
It's a kind of throbbing or pulsing sound. And when depending on how far apart those two slightly different frequencies are, I'm showing you with my hands.
Yes,
here, and I'm sure that
I can see John's hands moving up and down.
Depending on how far apart those tones are, that determines how fast or slow that beating or pulsing is.
Right.
And so the in both cases, those tones were made in the space, so that I'm kind of tuning them both to see what happens in the space with those beating tones, but also to kind of discover which tones excite the space the most, which ones are you know, the resonant frequencies of that particular space.
Yeah. And beside that, there are numerous tweeters in the room.
There are.
They represent the high frequency.
They're very, very high quality speakers, or usually just used as speaker components, that only deal with high frequencies.
Right. Okay. And is this sort of developed out of a theatre piece? Is that right, in Toronto?
It did. Yeah. I was interested before that theatre piece in working with high and low frequencies, and then I was approached to make sound for actually a Racine play, Andromaque.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of set in sort of generic Gulf War Afghanistan, so quite an intense thing.
Uh-huh.
And I don't normally work for theater, but they, I met with them. I liked the director, Graham McLaren, and I liked the theater company director as well, and Necessary Angel in Toronto. And they sort of said that, you know, as long as I understood that Graham was the director, I could have quite a lot of creative freedom. And that sounded fine for me. And they liked my ideas of using very low and very high frequencies. So I used it as an opportunity to start experimenting with those.
So that's where the piece originates from.
Yeah, I mean, that was my first time of using.
So that originally, then it would have worked with actors' voices over the top. Or?
Well, that's kind of why I wanted to use it, because I wanted, and the director wanted, sound to be a powerful force in the play. But there are a lot of words in the play as well, so I had to leave space for the actors, and I found that using low and high frequencies left them. I could still move the audience while they were still able to hear the actors.
Right, so it remains as a subtle undercurrent or something.
Most of the time, quite subtle, but sometimes quite sort of powerful as well.
Right. And in the gallery space, is it important that you can hear sound from outside as well, or there's some element of it's not just the sound within the gallery? Or
yeah, that's right. Now that's something I've been working with since before the theater piece. Even my 300 speaker piece at Beaconsfield was very much made in the space, listening to the sounds. In the case of Beaconsfield Gallery, it's right beside the main line trains between Waterloo and Vauxhall.
Yeah,
and the sounds of the train wheels on the tracks and the vibrations that sent through the building became a part of the piece.
Yeah.
And I synthesized sounds in the space that kind of worked with those sounds.
Right.
And I'm continuing with those ideas now. So when I was spending 2 weeks in Angus Hughes' gallery developing the piece, I was sort of sitting with my laptop synthesizing sounds, listening to squeaking brakes from outside, sirens going by, that kind of thing. And then not sampling them and not exactly trying to imitate them, but creating sounds that would relate in one way or another. So it might be just picking up the timbre of a particular sound coming in from outside, or the pitch or something like that, that would allow me, when I use those in the piece, to kind of almost sort of make the walls translucent acoustically, in a sense, so that some people have commented that sometimes it seems like a sound starts inside the gallery and ends up outside on the street, kind of thing, which isn't literally happening, but because I kind of bring up this kind of confusion between inside and outside that that seems to happen.
And does it is it a repeating cycle of sounds, or is it something that it changes throughout the day?
It is actually a loop, but I made quite a long loop. So for the amount of time that most people would spend in the gallery, it's not really a noticeable loop. But also because the ambient sounds are very important to the piece and very much part of the piece, and they're completely indeterminate, changing all the time. So in that sense, it never seems to repeat quite the same twice.
Right. And where do the sounds originate from? I mean, is it what is causing the sound just in the first place?
Well, as I say, a lot of the high frequency sounds are ones that I synthesized using kind of basic synthesis techniques in the gallery.
So they're computer generated.
Yes, yeah, they're all computer generated. There's no sort of recording.
There's no recording as such. No, okay.
And a lot of the sounds are also just pure sine tones.
As well. Right. Now, it's interesting because I had Simon Payne on last week, who's a video artist, and all of his work is also computer generated. I was talking to him about these barcodes and color barcodes, and he just, all of his visual work is originated within the computer. But he's also now recently gone back to using a camera and actually some element in the real world, shall we say. This is outside of the machine. Do you still do anything in that ilk?
Yeah, very much. Yeah. I did a piece recently using just environmental recordings from a project I did in Canada, which was one of my endangered languages project.
All right.
But I also made a lot of environmental recordings during that, my time working on that. And I made a piece recently which uses only the environmental recordings. A curator in Canada wanted a piece that had no voice elements.
Yeah.
So I used that as an opportunity to make a new piece just using environmental sounds from that.
Should we play some of the some of your installation? Should we play some recordings from it?
We can. There's no guarantee on the quality of these recordings. I just made them before I came into the studio.
Right.
So I haven't listened to any of them yet. They've not been edited or EQ'd or anything.
So this was recorded actually in the gallery whilst
the gallery, also not sure. Because there are a lot of very low frequencies, it's probably two-thirds of the sound won't come across on anyone's radio.
Oh, right.
But
okay.
I'll try and find...
Are they the low frequencies or the high frequencies?
The low. Some of the very high ones probably won't come across on most radios. That's what I'm saying. Probably two-thirds of the
Prepare
sound.
Prepare yourselves for silence. Okay.
But you might be able to hear some windows rattling.
Okay.
Or something like
Sounds
that.
Good.
So we may have to jump around a bit on the recording.
Okay.
I'm saying. So let's see what we've got here.
Here in the studio, we're getting a distinct throb from the studio speakers.
Yeah, I think what's happening there is when you put our studio mics down and the sound is coming, instead of through our headphones, coming through the studio speaker, the low frequencies are just causing distortion in that speaker.
Right.
So,
and I think that's designed to cut out the possibility of feedback in the studio.
Yeah.
But presumably, if people are listening to this at home or on their radio through speakers such as those, they would
more
get
likely even smaller speakers, but they'll probably just be getting distortion coming from them. Sounds okay on our headphones.
Yeah. Well, it sounds very clear on the headphones, but
yeah.
Oh, there's quite a.
Well, I think to. Well, what you can hear there is the windows rattling.
Oh, really?
So that low throbbing is the beat frequencies between two low frequency tones.
Sounds like a telephone I can hear.
That's the gallery phone.
Oh, right.
Going off. But I, when it went off when I was making the recording, I actually quite liked it because the piece is meant to kind of incorporate whatever happens.
Right. Oh, fine.
Inside the space or outside the space.
Yeah.
So it.
But the apparatus, is it the hard drive that is generating the signal?
It's playing from a hard drive.
Which, when I went to the opening, that piece of apparatus is in another room.
Yes, primarily because that and the amplifiers have fans on them, which make noise.
Okay. But would you wish it to be seen as well?
Oh, I have made pieces where the equipment's in the room if it doesn't have noisy fans on and things. I mean, you can hear in the quiet bits of the piece, you can hear the fan from the next room. It's similarly with my piece with the 300 speakers and the vacuum cleaner. The reason for the vacuum cleaner being outside of the main gallery space was because the vacuum cleaner's a noisy thing. I didn't particularly want that to dominate the piece sound-wise.
Right.
I mean, visually,
I was going to say the aesthetics of the thing are quite important to you, aren't they? It's not just the sound you're after. I mean, it is certainly with the 300 speaker pyramid. You obviously like the way that it looks.
I take visual things into account.
Right.
In a lot of my work, I try, and it's not always the case, but in most of my work, there aren't visual elements that don't have to do directly with the production of sound.
Right. Okay. And so in this case, I mean, the function speakers are attractive objects. I mean, they're quite impressive sculptural pieces in themselves.
Yeah.
But you're only interested in that in as much as they are part of the sound making.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, they're visually part of the effect of the piece, I think.
But you'd never have anything in the gallery that wasn't part of the sound apparatus.
That's true in a lot of my work. I wouldn't say all of my work. No. I mean, I did a piece that involved a slide, a 35mm slide, which obviously wasn't producing any sound. But
it was a projected image or just the slide?
It was a projector and a slide.
Oh, okay. What was the image?
That was a piece we may want to talk about.
Yeah.
called Hearing Loss, which was my piece with the three sets of hearing aids.
Would you rather talk about that later?
Up to you.
Oh, okay.
I'm wondering how our voices are coming across on the radio, since we don't know.
Yes.
Whether
well, shall I check with an engineer?
Well, maybe you could just let this run for a while and find out how.
having checked, apparently our voices can be heard. We have been advised to perhaps lower the installation sound somewhat, but we're okay. So is this the high frequency?
Those weren't particularly high frequencies, but that sound was coming out of the tweeters rather than the, the subwoofers. Yeah.
Right, and that was leading us on to another topic of the slide and high frequency something or other.
Yeah. Well, the piece with using hearing aids, were when my father died back in 2006, he left three pairs of in-ear hearing aids, which I wanted to use in a piece. And so I made a piece that only involved the feedback that those six hearing aids generated sort of between themselves, and just, I mean, a hearing aid is essentially a tiny microphone and a tiny speaker. So if you don't have your ear with one bit inside and one bit outside sort of stopping the feedback, then they just feed back. And so that piece was just the high frequencies created by that feedback.
Right.
One of the things I'll point out in what you can hear behind me now is that in the quieter bits of this piece, you really hear the kind of the traffic from outside the gallery space.
Sounds like a firework or something. There's a sort of
that's one of the sounds. Yeah.
So is that a phenomenon also created by the tweeters aimed at each other?
No, simply a sine tone that's got what's known as a low frequency oscillator that's making it sort of go up and down, in pitch.
And you mentioned I asked you about the slide. You were going to tell me what the image was.
The image in the slide was, it was a slide that a photograph my father took sort of in mid-Atlantic on what I discovered after kind of looking into the context of the box of slides I'd been looking through, was taken from the ship that we moved to Canada on back many years ago. I won't say how many years.
Okay.
Which I wasn't born in Canada, but I was brought up there. So when I was very young, we went on a ship to Canada. Mm. And for some reason, my father, very uncharacteristically, took a photograph of just the open sea with essentially nothing in it.
Right.
You know, most of the photographs were just the kids on deck and them at dinner or whatever. But that sort of...
So you selected this image from a bunch of other...
Yeah, it just seemed to work particularly well with the idea of a piece that had no real sound source, a kind of emptiness in a sense, and the piece is kind of about loss. It's an unusual piece for me, both because I used a visual image that isn't related to the sound directly, and because the piece is quite personal, and most of my work isn't very personal, either the language work or the installation work, like the one we've been talking about. It's not about me really in a direct sense, but that the hearing aid piece was quite a personal piece for me.
Okay. And what did your father do? What was he doing?
My father was a doctor.
Okay.
He and my mother met in London, in fact.
And that piece was exhibited. It was at one of the St. Thomas's operating.
That piece wasn't there. That piece has shown twice. Once in Vancouver, And then more recently here in London, at the same show, in the same group show I was in at Rochelle School.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. I have to stop this one first.
Okay, well, this seems an opportune moment to hear some of the hearing aid piece.
Yeah, I've got a couple of recordings from it. It was interesting, actually, because when I was working on that piece, I thought I knew I wanted to do something with the hearing aids and the feedback between them, and I thought to make it change at all, I thought I was going to have to introduce something that would make them move in relation to each other or something. But what I found actually was when I put them in a semi-contained space, a small box, that each of them has a kind of, I guess, a circuit that's meant to be a kind of noise gate that is meant probably to protect the hearer's ears from feedback.
Oh, right.
So it kind of cuts out the feedback at a certain point. And with six of them all going at the same time, what I found was that there was quite a bit of variation in sound, so I didn't have to introduce some element, which I was loath to do, that kind of somehow moved them around.
So are they're not amplified in any sense?
They're not
it
amplified.
Is literally just the hearing aids in a box.
Yeah, and it varies. I mean, if you put your hand over the box, it that changes the nature of the feedback, changes the sound. And they sound quite different when the batteries are fresh or when they're quite low. So let's hear a little bit maybe with fresh batteries.
So again, is this an endless piece? Does it sort of does it have a durational aspect? Or?
It's limited by the battery life, and also it's quite hard on the hearing aids themselves to be feeding back. So essentially, when it's been exhibited, it's only been sort of turned on and off during the day when visitors are there, rather than running all the time because they'll just burn out.
Yeah. Okay. Well, where should we move from there, John?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe we should have some country music.
Indeed. Okay. So we should remind listeners that you actually presented Up Country on Resonance FM for quite a few years, actually.
I did, but I think three or four years I did Up Country, yeah. It was...
Yeah. And didn't you do? Wasn't it present? Isn't there a special one that was presented in Newcastle?
That's right. Yeah, Vicky Bennett of People Like Us was curating a whole month of radio for the AV Festival in Newcastle, and she commissioned me to make a 2-hour episode of Up Country, which we're going to rebroadcast on Resonance sometime during the 10th anniversary.
Oh, right.
Hoopla.
Yeah. The upcoming celebrations of 10 years of Resonance in May, is it?
I think, yes.
Yeah. Okay. What was the brief of Up Country? Well, give us I know it always started with the music from the big country. That was its sort of the theme tune, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was a mix of country music, experimental soundworks, and the kind of dance music that makes you want to sit down.
Excellent. Okay.
I've said that a few times.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's head up country, John.
First guy I knew who died, I can't remember his name. The 10th grade started, he just never came again. All his friends sat around and cried for a day or two. You can say what you want about a mortal soul. When that guy died, it left a hole. It was my first clue that when they're gone, they're gone. Maybe Jesus beat that rap, we're not sure. Maybe you can live forever if your heart is pure. Maybe you'll come back someday as a king prong. Maybe angels come and take you away to heaven or the other way, but from down here it appears that when they're gone, they're gone. Me and Stevie Gibson used to walk home from school. He used to have this little turnaround rule. If you turn around in one way, you gotta turn around the other way or it's bad luck. Went out rafting on the river. The river went around and the raft went around, and his luck got all wound up and he drowned and he was gone. Maybe Jesus beat that rap, we're not sure. Maybe you can live forever if your heart is pure. Maybe you'll come back someday as a king prong. Maybe angels come and take you away to heaven or the other way, but from down here it appears that when they're gone, they're gone. 2 weeks after Dieter died, you could call him on the phone. He would tell you that he's not home, and it gave you an eerie feeling, even though you knew it was just an answering machine. 'Cause somewhere deep inside you know that they don't come back when they go, and he had gone, and when they're gone, they're gone. Maybe Jesus beat that rap, we're not sure. Maybe you can live forever if your heart is pure. Maybe you'll come back someday as a bugging along. Maybe angels come and take you away to heaven or the other way, but from down here it appears that when they're gone, they're gone. My mother died in intensive care. We were sitting around singing on folding chairs when I got the feeling somebody wasn't there. Well, I counted noses, but it came out right. The doctors say she died that night, but I felt that hole and I knew that she was gone. Maybe Jesus beat that rap, we're not sure. Maybe you can live forever if your heart is pure. Maybe you'll come back someday as a king prong. Maybe angels come and take you away to heaven or the other way, but from down here it appears that when they're gone, they're gone. I looked up death in the dictionary one day just to see what the dictionary had to say. It's the complete and irreversible cessation of life functions, which is not very poetic, but it's precise and clean. And if you analyze it, what that means is when they're gone, they're gone. Maybe Jesus beat that rap, we're not sure. Maybe you can live forever if your heart is pure. Maybe you'll come back someday as a king prong. Maybe angels come and take you away to heaven or the other way, but from down here it appears that when they're gone, they're gone.
I thought that was quite a good sort of post-Easter Friday the 13th number.
Indeed. Something about coming back as a king prawn.
Yeah. I don't know much about Dan Reeder, except some of the songs I was looking at this morning to bring in wouldn't have been playable before The Watershed.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, I see. What? Because of the profane language. Okay, but a lot of your tracks, your country tracks, have an element of humour about them, combined with death.
Yeah,
is that fair to say?
I don't know what it is. The theme of the episode of Up Country I did for the AV Festival was as slow as possible, or at least that was the festival's theme.
Hmm.
And when I started sort of putting tracks together and thinking about it, more and more of them became about death, because,
right.
I mean, that's as slow as you can get, I guess.
Yeah. As far as we know. So are you drawn towards death as a sort of topic? Or?
I guess I am.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we'll move on from that. Let's move on to the style of Upcountry tended to be like one country track, and then what should we call it? A more abstract sound.
Yeah, I kind of found ways of moving back and forth between the genres that, and I spent a lot of time kind of mixing things, basically, and putting maybe an Appalachian singer over a long drone track or things like that.
When you say over, you never mixed them.
Yeah,
such.
I do.
Did you?
Yeah.
All
right. Interestingly, because I used to be quite a purist and think that things shouldn't be mixed. Usually, if I have access to someone whose track I'm mixing with someone else's, I'll ask them their permission
first. Oh, really?
Like, okay. On that show, I used a track of Peter Kuzak's, so I just emailed him and said, yes, and do you mind if I mix your field recording?
It's very courteous
with
of you. I'm sure
else.
Most people don't do that.
Well, like I know some people get quite up in arms about people editing their work or mixing it with something else, and in some cases it's understandable, and I don't want to offend anyone, but I'm hoping I do it with some sensitivity and kind of come up with something new as a result, and also I when I do mix things, I try and give each thing its own kind of space as well before or after the mixed bit,
so it doesn't just turn to mush. It actually, you can still hear the distinct tracks.
It becomes more than the sum of the parts, I hope.
Right.
But yes, there was a certain sense of humor I tried to retain in Upcountry, despite my obsession with death.
Yes, well, death can be funny, can't it? So you're also very interested in endangered languages.
I've done a couple of projects now with endangered languages. The first one was with Click language speakers in the Kalahari Desert.
Hmm.
Working with a linguist from the University of Botswana, we made recordings. And I did a project from that which had various outcomes, an installation, an interactive CD-ROM I made with the Hans Rausing Endangered Languages Project at SOAS. I did a radio piece for Radio 3 based on that material as well.
Yeah, but I think you won an award for that, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And all right. So let's hear a piece of this. What's this next piece?
The piece that we were talking about when the Dan Reeder was playing is kind of a side project from a more recent endangered language project I did with a language in Canada called Gitsanamuch, which is one of the indigenous languages on the west coast of Canada. And they're in, particularly on the west coast of Canada, it's a real pocket of residual diversity, linguistically speaking. There are, similar to the Kalahari Desert, in fact, in that there are a lot of small-scale languages that are highly endangered.
Right.
In the case of the west coast of Canada, there are lots of languages which have only, you know, one or two, maybe six speakers left.
really?
But the language that I chose to work with for various reasons, partly because I thought there might be some value in helping to document the language and working in the community to help sort of raise the profile of the issue. So Gitsanamuk has, I think, somewhere in the region of 400 to 600 what linguists call competent speakers. Those are speakers who are completely fluent.
Yeah.
But the age of those speakers is getting older and older.
Yeah.
In fact, some of the speakers we worked with have died since. It's a language that's very much in trouble in terms of the future.
Right. So once again, it's sort of the theme is about the death of something, really. It's the death of a language in this case. But anyway, all right, let's hear a bit of hearing this next piece.
Well, the piece that we were going to play, you were asking me earlier about whether I use sort of real-world recordings in my work as opposed to synthetic sounds, which the more recent installation is about. So I thought I'd play this piece, which is a fairly recent piece I made from materials that I recorded on the native reserve called Kispiach or Anspiach in that language. But this was for a show in Canada where they didn't want they wanted environmental sounds. So I used that as an opportunity to make a piece that just used the environmental recordings. And so this is a piece called Kispiach. Thank you.
Okay. Well, apparently this is not a train we hear, but the sound of a dog panting.
It is, yeah. It wasn't deliberate, but the dog recording and the squirrel you hear behind now were recorded at the cemetery.
of course, yes.
On the reserve.
Right.
And we were there recording one of the speakers, and she was telling us about the graveyard and various sort of stories about the history of the community. Uh-huh. And there are a lot of bears in the area. And suddenly this dog just appeared, very large dog appeared out of the woods. And he was very friendly, and it was great having him around because we didn't have to worry about bears coming.
But, right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. Today's guest was sound artist John Wynn. Unfortunately, Richard Ducker couldn't make it from Fieldgate Gallery. And really, this is on the occasion of John Wynn's exhibition at the Angus Hughes Gallery, installation number 2 for high and low frequencies, curated by Fieldgate Gallery. John, maybe you could tell us, do you have the address of the gallery?
I do. The gallery is 26 Lower Clapton Road. That's E5OPD, or is that 0PD? E5.
Yeah. And it says here, it runs from April the 6th until the 29th.
That's right.
And it's open Friday, Saturday to Sunday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, 12 until 6 p.m. or by appointment.
Maybe I could just mention Richard is curating another show that's coming up in June and July at the Café Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
It's called, I'm just checking my notes from him here, Politics of Amnesia, which investigates the idea of technology and trauma and includes Tim Head and Marielle Neudecker, amongst others.
Okay. That's the Café Gallery in Southwark Park.
That's correct, yeah.
Right.
And that's in June or July, so if you're interested in that.
Yep. Okay. And upcountry will be coming up in May.
In the next couple of months.
And to give us a taste of upcountry, what are we going to end up with, John?
Well, a track by Jolie Holland, who is Canadian and was in a group called the Be Good Tanyas, who did some very fantastic work. And the song.
And what's the name of this song?
I Want to Die.
I see. Okay. All right. Thank you very much to John Wynn for coming in. And we'll end up with I Want to Die.
But I'm out here.